Hello, extra time.
Very important to the league not to get a hold because it damages your reputation. It makes people, when they read it, just laugh at you.
The single club, they're playing in the League One, and they're playing in the Europa League, and they're credit. The game in this country.
You're welcome along to the ExtraTime.ie sportscast, although we may look to rename that one, as there is absolutely no sport at the moment. We're going to have to figure out what we're going to talk about in the meantime. No, we are going to do our best to keep the episodes coming and to keep it as much of League of Ireland and sort of Irish football chat in general. We probably will stray a little bit from that in the next few weeks, although I imagine it's going to be a bit like today's, mainly around that kind of content you can rifle through in your spare time now that I imagine you've got a little bit of it. This week's show, I'm quite delighted actually to get a member of Treaty United, John Grehan. Treaty United, of course, formerly Limerick United. He was formerly an assistant manager at Limerick FC, and John has come on to talk to us about Treaty United. If you don't remember, they were originally Limerick United, as I mentioned. They'd sort of formed when it looked like Limerick FC had fallen apart completely and basically disappeared, and then all of a sudden there was all sorts of legal challenges and issues. We're going to get into that with John today. We were basically not around. We were stopped recording for a couple of weeks when this all went down, so we sort of missed a large chunk of the story. So delighted to get John on to talk about Treaty United and the future of academy football in Limerick as well. I'll also be speaking to our own Dylan O'Connell for a bit of an update on Cork City and the whole, well, they won't they take over proceedings there, and exactly what is going on at the moment and where Cork City are actually at. Right now on the line, joining me, Mokhtar Ferris. And Mokhtar, great to have you on. We're going to revisit something we did in some of our Advent podcasts previously, and people should go back and listen to them, I would suggest.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about books this evening. So I'm delighted to be on, Declan. Yeah, if people were looking to maybe support their local bookshop, I know lots of bookshops are taking orders on the phone and online, getting stuff out to people, and if they have a bit of spare time, we've kind of got some of our classic books, if you like, that we might chat through about football, and I've dug out some non-football as well that we can have a talk to. So hopefully people will be interested in that, might get a few ideas for some books they might want to read over the next while, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, they could do what I did, which is pile through sort of old boxes of books and see what you have left, because I sort of let go of a fair few sports books and autobiographies some time ago. It's only more recently I've turned back to quite a lot of sports reading, but I managed to ruffle out a beauty, a full-time secret life of Tony Cascarino as told to Paul Kimmich. So we might do a bit on that, because I've basically got rid of my cabin fever by spending all day taking that one apart. It's not the longest or toughest read now, but it was a bit of a surprise to me. But I think what we'll do first is we probably will start with a few of your own, Mokhtar, just to get people warmed up. You've given me a sort of list of some of your all-time top five favourites in the sports category, or in the football category and the non-football category. Let's start with one that I'm going to join you in a little bit. I don't think this is on your list, but I kind of want to talk about, I'm not even going to say this right, Futebol, The Brazilian Way of Life by Alex Belas. For me, it's the definitive book on football in Brazil. I mean, if you haven't had a read of that, you don't know any of the backstory of Brazil. It's got everything, doesn't it? It's really an encyclopedia type thing.
Oh, it is a real classic. It's one that I have. It's a well-thumbed copy that I have in it as well. So, it's a really good book. It's a travelogue.
I've made it quite boring calling it an encyclopedia, actually. It's not an encyclopedia at all. It's just in terms of volume of content and brilliant information it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some really great stories about the football pitch that's built on the equator. So one half is in the northern hemisphere and the other half is in the southern hemisphere. Brilliant. Really good section on one of the clubs in, let me get this right, Vasco da Gama, I think, in Rio, and the Sao Janeiro Stadium. And I'm lucky enough, I've been to Brazil a couple of times now, can I say that? So the first time was way back, maybe 2006, maybe, and I went to the Sao Janeiro Stadium in Rio, which is a wonderful stadium. It's a horseshoe-shaped stadium. With one end has just a church behind the goal, and then the Christ Redeemer statue is in the foreground. And the chairman of that club is quite a character. Eurico Miranda is one of the chapters in the book. But yeah, I enjoyed a day there. I actually saw Romario play that day.
Oh,
scored
nice.
A goal. And recommended it to a couple of friends of mine when they were going traveling through South America. They definitely should go to a match there, which they did, and promptly got tear gassed when there was a bit of a riot. But hey,
you gotta take the good with the bad.
So. Exactly. Yeah. So there's a chapter on not the most PC chapter on. Well, actually, it probably calls it out for what it is, which is a combination of football tournament and kind of like a Miss Universe as well.
It's very much like the Father Ted thing, the lovely ladies,
the lovely girls,
except with a Brazilian flair and. It was one of the things I had mainly to bring up was that it's a very conflicting read, that part, because, I mean, it is shambolic. It's essentially, I mean, if the football team gets knocked out, they can be kept in it by their beauty model, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's maybe a book of its time, can I say?
I don't think, 2002.
I think we've moved on. I'd like to think we've moved on a little bit. Maybe they haven't in Brazil, but... But yeah, it's just a real flavor for just how much football permeates life in Brazil. And there's, you know, it goes back to, it was written before the 7-1 defeat in the World Cup that Brazil undertook with Germany. But it goes to the previous worst day, which was when they lost the World Cup final to Uruguay. And it goes into that in quite a lot of detail and how that scarred the nation. That's a really good book. Definitely will be in my top 10, although I think I gave you a top 5, which was really difficult to try and pick from.
And I picked one that wasn't even in it. One thing I mainly wanted to mention this for, actually, was that Brazil was sort of at the foreground of small clubs having video editing facilities that they could basically take player highlights, use it to distribute on the internet and have people buy them. So, I mean, use them as exports, which I loved as an idea. I thought, you know, it seems to be happening a bit more. I mean, say take something like the Jordan Flores clip that's been seen around the world and how they'd market that. I mean, that's what Brazil, I mean, you go back to, do you remember Curlon? Remember seeing all the videos of him, the sort of seal thing where he had the ball on his head? I mean, that was before nearly anyone knew who Curlon was. It was just those videos going around. So it's just fascinating to me that they were able to do that kind of thing. I think more clubs really should have done it. Well, they are starting to do it now, but it's just great. That book is from years ago, like and just how far advanced they were at some of the, sort of selling the Brazilian, you know, footballing dream to people. Let's stick into some of your other ones, because we're going to spend too long on just one book that I absolutely love and could talk about for hours. Give me another one of your top football books then.
I tried to pick books that were really like stood out and maybe were a bit groundbreaking. And I think Fever Pitch is one, and maybe people see Fever Pitch and see Nick Hornby and maybe think, oh, not for me. You know, it's about Arsenal, and maybe they saw the film with John Cusack. Or there was the John Cusack one with baseball, Fever Pitch, for the American version. And then, I can't remember the actor now, did an equivalent for football. But I think it was a groundbreaking book in that it talks about what being a football fan is about. So there's not a lot of football autobiographies in the top 5 list. Although I do like the Tony Cascarino one, I love, which is very honest. It even lists out how much he earned for every contract that he played, which is about as honest as you get. But I think the Fever Pitch talks about what it is to be a fan just prior to the Premier League. So the kind of the build up to the book, if people don't know, Hornby is like Arsenal fan, lived very close to Highbury. So the build up a lot is to the year that Arsenal won the league at Anfield in the kind of impossible match where they needed to win 2-0 and they managed it. But it was just before maybe football came into the mainstream. It was still the Football League at that stage. It wasn't the Premier League. But I think it's still a book that stands the test of time. And I think it's a book that's well worth going back to, even if you have read it before, to go back to it again. And if you haven't read it, I'd certainly recommend it for people to pick it up and have another look at it.
It's one of the few that they've not tried to remake in recent, because I only saw recently High Fidelity, one of his most famous books, has been remade as a new series with a sort of Ghostbusters twist. The lead man is now played by a lady, and they tried, if I remember correctly, to to redo A Long Way Down, which is another one of his books, to disastrous consequences with Pierce Brosnan and your man Jesse from Breaking Bad. So go check those out if you dare. But one I don't really know a whole lot about, and you have very high on your list, is a book called A Season with Verona by Tim Parks. I imagine it's what it says on the tin.
Yeah, so Tim Parks travelled around the country following Verona, but he wasn't quite embedded. He wasn't in the dressing room. He was more embedded in the Curva and with the Ultras. And Verona have a bit of a reputation, actually. They're more right-wing maybe than left-wing. But Parks lives in Italy. He's an English author. Like, one of his books is shortlisted for the Booker Prize. So he writes fiction. But he lives in Verona, and he spent a year. Let me see if I can find what year it is written on the back. Can't quite find out. But he travelled from north to south of Italy, and it was just 2002 it was written. I think Tim Parks gave it a great insight what it means to be a football fan who travels home and away, and also how badly treated the away fans are in Italy, and maybe in the League of Ireland people can maybe feel some of that pain as well. But I think it's a really good idea of what the fan culture is like in Italy, and tells a story of you know how the season went, the ups and downs as you know football fans we get as we travel home and away to watch teams. So I think it's definitely one that's recommended. And interestingly enough, if I can recommend another podcast, is I listen to Between the Lines, which is a podcast that Backpage Press do. And they actually did one in the last month, an interview with Tim Parks, and he hasn't really done a lot of interviews about it. He kind of wrote this book, and then everyone wanted to talk to him about it, and he kind of wanted to get back to his maybe more normal writing that he did. So the interview that they did recently, I think, is really worth listening to. He talks about writing the book, kind of the influence of the book, and maybe why he shied away from talking about the book for a while as well. So that one comes recommended from me.
Between the Lines, not to be mixed up with another League of Ireland podcast, of course. Before we get on to a few more of your own and a few of the non football books, let's go to Cascarino's book, because this is one I kind of wanted to do a little bit of what we've done on the Advent podcast, which is sort of profile type situation of this book, because it's one I found very, very interesting. It's very much not judging a book by its cover. I'll be straight up. I had this left over my house because I bought it in a bargain bin yonks ago. I never really paid much attention to it. And I was talking to you about it earlier today, or when we were talking about doing a few books, and you were saying to me, Full Time is actually a cracking book. So I said, right, I'll give it a go, because I was in the middle of only starting into really a couple of chapters into Don McRae's book. But the boxing up north in the Troubles, which is in Sunshine or in Shadow, which so far is absolutely gripping stuff. Early Doors talking about South African apartheid and the Northern Irish complex comparison. So well worth a read from the early readings I've done of that. But this one, it sort of really, really surprised me. I'll say I wasn't expecting to turn the first couple of pages, given that I've pigeonholed Cascarino a little bit and you know, on the stories of him talking. There's stories from Niall Quinn of him and Andy Townsend when the Taoiseach, Charlie High, came into a game once, and the lads were told, they were like, who's that, who's that? And they were told it's the Taoiseach, and they thought he was some bloke who owned a tea shop. So you kind of pigeonhole the lads a bit like that. And then he starts opening up chapters with quotes from Salomon Rushdie or Kurt Vonnegut.
Probably should mention the ghostwriter.
Yeah, well, I was getting to that. Paul Kimmage, of course, is going to be the man who's put each of those in, almost certainly, unless, because just blew me away to see Salomon Rushdie referenced in Tony Cascarino's in his book. And what I found really interesting about this, you mentioned the kind of the honesty that's in it, and I think that's well worth noting when he talks to Paul Kimmage about doing this, and he kind of references it later on in the book, basically saying that it wouldn't be for the money, and Kimmage is sort of wondering, why do you even want to do this kind of thing? And he's saying, I'm not interested in talking about games I've played, the goals I've scored, the wankers I've met in dressing rooms. I'm not interested in hurting anyone but myself. Kimmage asks him, why would you want to hurt yourself? Essentially, because I've made mistakes, hurt my two boys, and basically because a lot of people sort of make assumptions about him. He talks about some of the fans and some of the guff he gets at times. And you know, it's probably fair enough when a striker's not going to be scoring goals. We know that about football. But he's just kind of keen to, you know, he says, after 18 years of being cheered and jeered and analysed, I'd like people to know who I am. I really haven't gone off autobiographer so long. I think this one really caught me by surprise how much better it is than I thought it would be.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier on about books breaking the mould. And I think this probably did. You know, Paul Kimmage's name is on the front cover. Like, a lot of the time, the ghostwriter, I think these days maybe the ghostwriter gets a little bit more credit, but before you mightn't even see the name of the ghostwriter. But so this is a warts and all. Like, it's very honest. And at times, you know, I wouldn't say it's too honest, but you come away going to Cascarino, God, there was definitely mistakes that he made, and he doesn't come across in certain instances as a very likable character in a couple of occasions as well.
One thing on that, it's not too apologetic, is the thing. It's not honest, yeah. And it's not explaining what a mess it was. He just straight up says that he was an asshole in some parts and talks about sort of the post-success with Ireland and you know, the sort of feel, the celebrity feeling that goes along with it. So there's some really big highs, sort of contrast nicely with really big lows. I thought there's an amazing piece in it as well, where he basically talks, Nancy, a weird team that are in the news at the moment, because I believe Man City are actually looking to take them over. And of course, that's where Cascarino ended I think he went on to Red Star after, but he ended his time in France there, having gone brilliantly with Marseille. And he talks about in a game where they lost 2-0 to Nantes, and he played an absolute shite game, and just how low he was with football at that point. I'm feeling as low as I have been since coming to France. I'm sick of the team, sick of the game, sick of everything about it. On a rented jet ride home, which is the small jet basically they were in for the team, I actually wanted the thing to crash. You know, so there's some serious low points in it. And one thing I wanted to bring up to you, actually, again, I'm picking out a few quotes here that I'd kind of jotted down. But one thing he talks about was the sort of international career when he's... What I liked about the book is it didn't start in his humble beginnings and grow into it. It starts fairly prominently towards the end of his international career and goes back and touches on a few of those bits, but it's not too long in the sort of origin story of Cascarino. And he talks about having gone from I was a wonderful servant to the team, then a faithful old warrior, still prepared to give his all. But the tide had been turning slowly ever since. It's the little things you notice, the kids running past you with autograph books, and essentially then talks about radio shows he's heard with John from Mullingar calling in to tell him that he's a disgrace, or calling in to tell people that he was a disgrace, and how can they keep picking him. I think that actually really sums up Ireland quite nicely as well with this, because I always felt Robbie Keane seemed to non-stop get this towards the end of his career, which is amazing, because I don't think in say the aforementioned Italy, they love players like that. They want to see Filippo Inzaghi get a run out when he's 36 to tap the ball into the net and do absolutely feck all else. Like,
well, Cascarino was a great servant for Ireland, and many people would have probably watched the Boys in Green documentary over the last couple of weeks, and Cascarino talked about, if he's asked about his favourite goal, it's the goal he scored against England in Lansdowne Road in the qualifiers for, must have been Euro 92, I think it was. But he always seemed, it was either Niall Quinn or it was Tony Cascarino. I don't think that the two of them were obviously very similar in physical stature and what they brought to the game, but Quinn maybe with a bit of Quinn with the better touch for the big man, as you say. But he was a great servant for Ireland. But the book, certainly when it came out, there was the controversy over actually whether he was eligible to play for Ireland or not. And of course, it turned out he was, but he felt he wasn't in relation to, you know, where his qualification came from. I think his grandparents were, or his grandfather maybe was from Mayo, I think it was. But I remember when the book came out, that was the big takeaway. But I think there's a lot more to it in it. And I think, as you say, he doesn't, there's no apologies for him at certain points, explaining what he did in his life. But a lot of people maybe just know him as almost a football commentator these days, and might remember him, you know, playing with Marseille, playing with Millwall, playing with Celtic, playing with not a very good spell, I think, with a couple of clubs as well. Yeah. And how he kind of blossomed towards the end of his career when he went to France, and, you know, the idea of someone who went to France, grew up in an English football league, but actually took the decision to go elsewhere. Now, maybe there weren't too many offers that were going at the time, but actually, you know, probably prolonged his football career. And, you know, he was relatively successful playing in France across, I think, four or five seasons.
Massively, yeah. One thing I noticed in this book as well, that it has, having similarly read, or recently, I should say, read Richie Sadler is Recovering, both of them use that inner voice monologue to talk about their sort of inner turmoil and the putting themselves down element, the not having the mentality for it. Cascarino has more of a conversation. It's nearly like watching that Lord of the Rings where Gollum and Sméagol are talking in Cascarino's head, because he has pages of dialogue where he's talking to himself and arguing with himself, whereas Richie's is more insulting himself in that voice. But it's just funny, you see the mentalities of guys like this and the damage that's caused mainly in both of their cases, actually, largely by their fathers and some of their resulting problems. But I actually met Cascarino in one of our offices before he came in for something in one of the jobs, and he's quite a personable fella. And when you're talking about before, sort of knowing him as this kind of commentator, I'd probably nearly be in that mold myself now at this stage, having only really the Ireland games to remember him. I don't think I'd have watched any of them really towards his later club days, or seen much of him at all. And meeting him was sort of that sort of surreal thing as well, because it was nearly, we had to get him in and get a few bits done and get him done, but he kind of had a little bit of time to stick around. It would have been during the day after Germany smashed Brazil, weirdly enough, as we're talking about Brazil at the start. And I kind of have to outcast a little bit here, because after talking a little bit about it and a few bets and stuff like that, he basically admitted that he backed Fred as top goal scorer at a tournament. And if you remember, Fred was actually nationally despised by the end of that tournament when he returned to Brazil, which I suppose something that Cass could really relate to in his book, talking a little bit about how he was treated by, say, Chelsea, Aston Villa, Celtic, anywhere but Ireland nearly. And strange to see him on Sky Sports now, because really he should be doing the LRTE rounds or something like that, shouldn't he?
Yeah. Well, I think he's probably better regarded by Irish football fans than fans of those clubs that you mentioned.
Massively. Only hearing in France, I would say. Gillingham, where he started out his career, not probably a whole lot of love, but there is some really good stuff in that. I have to say it's sort of reignited my passion a little bit now to go and find these ones that have sort of written off. But it's, yeah, definitely when we're talking about a couple of books, as I said, bargain bin, found it a while ago, decided to have a spin today. Pretty easy one to read as well. Nothing too...
It's a couple of hundred pages.
Yeah. It's very straightforward, so nothing too difficult. You get through it fairly solidly, and even the chapters aren't too bulky. As I said, there's nothing that does my head in more, McDara, than either a movie or a footballer's book or something like that just overdoes it with the origin story. It's like, I don't need to know where, you know, the street you grew up on. I don't need to know all that. You know, presume a little bit of prior knowledge on my part that I can get my head around that you grew up. I don't need to know it all. Right, I tell you what, before we get on to John Graham, talking to John, and getting Dylan in to talk about Cork, why don't you give me a few more of the sort of non-football books for people who might have switched off at this point because of all the football talk?
Well, one of the books that's regularly mentioned as one of the best sports biographies is Andre Agassi's autobiography called Open. And again, it's another brutally honest one. Starts with him trying to get out of bed, can barely pull on get his socks on, his back is in such a bad way. But it's another book that was, well, the ghostwriter, I think, was quite important. So it's a guy called J.R. Moringer, who was actually a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. So this guy can write, and he obviously was able to get the really best story out of Agassi. There's a lot about his trying to woo Steffi Graf, which is quite interesting, and also how Agassi hated tennis, which I think is the best bit nearly in the book. And again, another a relationship that's pretty fractured with his father as well. So I might I'll mention that one. I might move on quickly, unless there was anything you wanted to ask on that one.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about Agassi, but he's pretty much tennis's big superstar, isn't he, of the last few years, maybe Barbaros Becker?
Yeah, and then there's what he was a prem, went prematurely bald, and there's some wonderful bits about how like he wore a wig. So this is before the days of
weirdly that
hair transplant.
Weirdly, that links into Cascarino's book. Is something I forgot to mention on that was the fact that he was he went from working on a building site to being a hairdresser, and then to being a footballer. And he actually talks about there should be a thesis done on men losing their hair and what it does to them.
Well, there's a couple of chapters in Agassi's book where you can actually where you can do that as well. So yeah, like hilarious match where he's more worried about that the toupee is going to fall off his head, whether that he's going to actually win the match as well. But he was, you know, he was a bit of a enfant terrible. He like wearing whites wasn't his thing, but you know, he played in denim. But then when he went and qualified for Wimbledon, he turned up in just spectacular all whites, and he just embraced Wimbledon, and he won a number of Grand Slams. So it's even if you're not into tennis, there's loads in there you can get out of it.
I've got one to ask you then, because we kind of have to wrap this up. Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, is one that stuck out to me, because again, I know absolutely F all. I've had a go in Bundoran, and that's about as far as I can go.
Yeah, I don't know whether you'd call it really a sports book. So William Finnegan is the author, and it's an autobiography. It actually won the Pulitzer Prize for biography in 2016. But it's more maybe a travelogue. You know, Finnegan grew up in California and Hawaii. His father, I think, was a producer on Hawaii Five-O, which I used to watch on reruns, if I can say that, on Wednesday afternoon, when I really should have been doing computer studies in college. But anyway, enough about that. But then how he spent kind of travel the world to get the perfect wave. So Australia, Asia, Africa. And like he writes for, I think it's Sports Illustrated that he writes for. Maybe it's the New Yorker. I should probably have a look at this and read the back of the book. But so he's a wonderful writer. So it talks about surfing. You don't necessarily need to be a surfer. But it's just a wonderful kind of travelogue through someone's life as they're trying to attain and surf the perfect wave. So whether you're trying to, you know, do whatever perfectly in what you're trying to do in life, this is what this guy was trying to do. And I really enjoyed it. So that was another one. But I don't know, it's not a surfing, it's not, well, it is a competitive sport, but he didn't surf competitively. So I don't know, we may be stretching the definition of what a sports book might be.
That's all right. I think they'll let us away with that one, given that any sort of content like that. So we'll put a list of that up in the description, all the books mentioned there. We're going to speak to John Grennan, and then we're going to get on to the bit of Cork City chat with Dylan O'Connell in just a few moments. Daniel Carr, great to have you on. Are you enjoying your time here so far?
Yeah, so far I've been loving it. I mean, loving it so far.
Will I give that one another go? The phone fall, did it?
Yeah.
Log on to extratime.ie.
Now, in the off-season, when we hadn't ourselves been working on the podcast, we had, the pretty terrible news that we had Limerick FC seemingly go under, and after a long saga of players not being paid, and the likes of the Sean Russell injury and the whole saga with him, which we discussed in an earlier show, essentially being left with his bills for physio and various other things being unpaid. So many problems at Limerick at that time, but in that time, when we had stopped broadcasting, Treaty United, a group involving a number of ex-Limerick coaching staff and quite a few other people, set up looking to establish an academy of football to sort of fill the void for young footballers in Limerick. The group ultimately had to step away for their attempt to get licensing in place from the FAI at the start of the season under legal threats. Joining me now on the line is former Limerick assistant manager and one of the members of Treaty United. It's John Grennan. John, can you tell us your experience at the start of the season, I suppose, that culminated in Treaty United having to withdraw from the process?
Yeah, how you doing, Declan? Thanks very much for having me on. I suppose we came about, as you stated, we were former coaches of Limerick FC predominantly, and a group of local kind of business people and people in the business community were going to form a board. And it all came about from a sense that there would be no underage National League football So we initially came together, felt that we could fill a void and maintain and preserve National League football in the Midwest region, and Limerick being the base. And that's essentially how it came together. It was just like-minded people that didn't want to lose what we'd worked so hard for over 7 years, you know?
Absolutely. And then when you came together and ultimately decided to put that process into action, it seemed to go at the start fairly from strength to strength, because I'm thinking back that of the sort of public reaction and the amount of people turning up to the launch and the involvement at that point. You must have thought it was, you know, was all pretty well set in motion.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, from the outset, it was a group of coaches being approached by previous administrators that would have been involved at Limerick in some capacity. And as I said, we had the coaching football experience, given that Tommy Barrett was going to lead us and the rest of the coaches were UEFA qualified coaches. The administrators were proficient in what they were doing. And then we brought on the likes of Con Murray, who was the former CEO of Limerick City and County Council, a gentleman by the name of Sean O'Brien, who was in the business community in Shannon, and John Hannan was going to be the treasurer. We'd some really strong people, and our motives and momentum were moving in the right direction. We were in consultation with the FAI. Unfortunately, we hit a kind of a buffer when, innocently or naively, we settled on the name Limerick United, and that threw up our first kind of bump in the road. But outside of that, we were doing our due diligence, we were sourcing funding, we had the coaches, and we had a lot of goodwill behind us in advance of announcing ourselves and advertising for trials.
And just to clarify for people in that time, I should as well, that the name Limerick United and a bunch of other Limerick names were owned, apparently trademarked, by the previous Limerick administration. So in saying that at the time, John, I'm right in saying it would have been sort of under 13s to under 19s, and you would have had trials and all at that point, wouldn't you?
Well, when we issue, you know, sought to partake in season 2020, you have to request or submit an expression of interest to the FAI, which we did. And a presentation actually happened up in Abbottstown with a couple of the board members. And it was favourably looked upon, given the content of the presentation and how we'd done our due diligence, you know, in terms of explaining to them how we'd fund ourselves, explain who we'd have on board in terms of coaching and the whole kit and caboodle. So we were ratified and accepted in under the name Limerick United, and never for one moment did we think that it would cause an issue, given that, you know, the previous entity had entered into administration, and for all intents and purposes, it looked to us like it was not going to have the capacity to provide football in the Midwest region. When we discovered through a legal challenge that we had to desist using the Limerick United name because it was rightfully under the ownership of the previous chairman of, Pat O'Sullivan, we immediately desisted from using the name, you know, and there's no question that the man owns the name and various other names, you know, and we desisted. There was no hesitation, and we had to then decide what name could we use. We were advised that probably best not to use a name with Limerick in it, given, you know, that the impact that it might have in terms of conflict with other names held by the other party. So we settled on the Treaty United name, given that Limerick is famed for its Treaty Stone. Treaty United was the name we settled on. And we developed a crest, and we went away again thinking we've been ratified. The only change is a small change. But we then faced another legal challenge saying that we shouldn't be allowed move forward with our expression of interest because we changed name. Aligned with that was the well-documented High Court action from Limerick FC and the FAI, where they felt they were entitled to be invited in, and it would appear that they were correct, and they were allowed be invited to apply for senior license for season 2020. There was a timeline on that, as far as I'm aware, and no submission was ever forwarded. But in that space, it was decided by the board of Treaty United now that we'd step aside So there'd be no muddying of the waters, and we wouldn't impact on Limerick FC's application for a senior licence. When they didn't apply for a senior licence, it seems they applied for an expression of interest, and we were deemed redundant then at that stage in terms of our expression of interest. We had, up to that point, we had actually legitimately advertised our trials, held our trials. We were oversubscribed at all the age groups, and in numbers we could have fielded, like, given that the squads are 20 player squads, in 13s, 15s and 17s, we could have had three squads, you know, given the level of interest and oversubscription for willing to participate. So it was disappointing when we had to pull away and explain to all the parents and kids why.
And this is the thing as well, I presume, I mean, a lot of you working with Treaty United, as I mentioned earlier, would have been involved with Limerick in some capacity, whether it's like yourself coaching or in another position. But obviously yourself and Tommy would have been involved at the time I mentioned earlier when there was a number of difficulties with the club. Was Treaty United just an element of moving away from that trouble and trying to start anew?
Yeah, we it was purely because we saw there was going to be a void in football that we came together. You know, had Limerick FC, and if you it's well documented, if you go back, there was financial troubles as far back as 2018 with budget cuts and staff cuts and players having to be, you know, moved on. You know, Brendan Clark, Connor Clifford were all part of the Limerick squad in 2018. They were moved on, and that was the four signals that there was financial difficulties. That escalated, it would seem, in 2019, where in the first month of March, the players received their wages, and there was a deal or a muted kind of arrangement with a local business car firm that they were going to cover every second month in the wages, as we understood it, and that's in the press, local press. That never materialised. You know, the first month was paid by the local car sale company. They took a sponsorship on the jersey for their money. And thereafter, the players never received any payment. And there was a separation in the ways between the car company and yeah. Chairman.
Yeah, we did talk about that at the time, all right. And it was it was just yet another one of those, as I said, in a saga of issues, it did seem to bring it on quite a bit. I wonder, though, I mean, presumably you guys thought you were acting more as a sort of succession plan, because, I mean, as far as I was aware, Limerick FC, as it stood, was gone. I wasn't actually aware that there was still any thoughts of coming about. But presumably you guys wanted to act as that, fill the void, as you said, with maybe the idea of having first or Premier Division ambitions at some point.
But that was exactly it. Definitely, like, you know, we saw a void occurring, and, you know, the entity that was Limerick FC was in examinership. No payment had come across to the players in full in the season 2019. You know, there was part payments, very reduced payments. There's still players unpaid, and that's documented as part of the examination process. Tommy Barrett remains unpaid. Dave Rooney remains unpaid. And there's a whole host of creditors which are, you know, listed on that examination process. So we clearly felt that there is going to be no Limerick FC in season 2020. So we just did not want to, after, you know, working so hard to get elite level football up to a decent standard in the Midwest region, you know, we were drawing players from Clare, Limerick, North Tip, Kerry. And if you look around the League of Ireland, you know, First Division, Premier Division, you have Limerick players in terms of Carlo Sullivan at Finn Harps, Lee Devitt, Adam Foley down in Cove, Killian Bruder, Jack Lynch up in Galway, you know, Jack Brady's at Shelbourne. So they're all Limerick players that would have come through the academy structure or the first team under Tommy Barrett. And we just did not want to see that cease, you know.
Have you and the Treaty United group, I suppose, since then had much correspondence with the FAI?
Our conversations with the FAI would have ceased when we withdrew our expression of interest on the basis that we'd leave a clear path for Limerick FC to apply for the senior licence as they had requested through the High Court process. When they didn't submit, to the best of my knowledge, a licence application and then submitted an expression of interest, we were kind of left in the wilderness. And we, at that point, it was so late in the day, and we had to, in fairness to the, you have to think about the players and all this, the young kids. We had, between the four groups, Declan, on trial, and then, you know, like I said to you, there's 80 kids that are going to get signed. Mm. We had close on 200 kids in on trial. When we were told, and the legal challenges were made against us, the windows for transferring players from clubs, because the way the seasons work, you know, summer season into winter season, or winter season, as some of them had reverted to, all traditional seasons, their windows were on top of us, and we were coming under attack from local league secretaries, you know, not facilitating transfers. So we had to make a decision in the interest of the kids, which was let them go back to their clubs and play football in some shape or fashion, because we weren't going to have enough time with all the legal challenges to you know, proceed. So we took a, you know, part of our decision-making process centered around the kids and what was right for the kids. So we released them, and the forms that we had signed them on became redundant, null and void. We advised them to go back to their clubs. And we also encouraged, because at the same time, Limerick FC were advertising for underage trials, because they were pushing that they were now the entity that was going to be allowed to participate. And so we encouraged the kids to go across. We wanted the kids playing League of Ireland, so we encouraged them to go across. But some didn't want to go across.
Right.
The momentum, and there was a, you know, just a latent kind of, you know, why should we play for an entity that didn't fulfill its obligations in the last number of years? You know, it's well documented. So people don't want to be associated with that, Declan.
No, interesting. And I suppose that might lead us on slightly to the an interesting element of the story, which is the Women's National League. Of course, the team entered there is under Treaty United and not Limerick FC. Can you tell us why that is, and whether that we should expect that to continue, or will it likely have to revert back?
No. That's a standalone entity this season, and Trojan work was done by the board behind the women. The women came into being two seasons ago from memory, maybe three seasons. Dave Rooney was to the forefront of that. Irene Herher was doing, he was with David. There's John Paul Buckley and Niall Connolly in there this year. They realised that, like ourselves, there was a potential for Limerick FC not to be an entity, given that it was in examinership with reported debts of 490,000, and the likelihood and the advice from the examiner that it should be put into liquidation. So they realised we better get into discussions with the FAI, which they did. When it was muted that we'd put together this group for the boys' side of it, we joined forces, we drove it as one vehicle, and they adopted our name, Treaty United. They were going to be Limerick United. They adopted the Treaty United name. Women's football is a growing, you know, sport in this country. It needs a lot of support, and it was massively important that it was maintained in the Midwest region, and Dave Rooney deserves huge credit for driving that. And so they had their discussions with the FAI, and the FAI said, no, you can stay as Treaty United, you can partake in the league this year, and they were allowed to continue on.
Well, fair enough. Well, hopefully it does indeed go from strength to strength then. So I suppose I must ask you where we are in the process of sorting all this out at the moment, and for people who might have been following the Limerick story, and maybe it sort of died away because it doesn't seem really to be talked about all as much. And ultimately, can you tell us what the future is of Treaty United?
Well, I suppose without being too glib about it, at the moment, Treaty United are in a holding situation because we can't participate in the underage leagues for 2020, by the virtue of the fact that we told the players to go back, or we encouraged the ones to go across to Limerick FC, because that's the options we had at a point in time. Season is due to start on Saturday, but obviously coronavirus has overtaken matters. But you, look, from our perspective, you've always got a hope. You know, hope in 2020 was really important for us. It's still, we're still hopeful. But I would like to think that if things get dealt with from the FAI and Limerick FC's perspective, that we might have a clear path to revisit this for season 21. And I'd have no doubt that if we communicate and advertise as Treaty United for season 21, we'll get all those players that we had back to us, and the same coaches have, you know, they've already indicated that they'd like to stay, because there was a good momentum, there was a really good sense that we were doing something well, and that we had the momentum and support of the public and the business community. I mean, there was massive amount of support and help from the business community when we were in the few months that we were together. I won't detail it because it'd be wrong to do that, but I can assure you that there was support behind us, given, you know, that we were an honest, transparent group that were motivated by just, you know, the right ingredients for football in the Midwest region.
Well, look, we hope there is some clarity, Sean, on that in the next little while, and that we can, you know, have a proper finish to this. But John, before we do let you go, I suppose if people want to keep updated in the story or the Treaty United project, which, as I said, seems to have slipped out from the public consciousness at the moment, which is quite disappointing, but where's the best place they can do that? Is there somewhere that they can, I suppose, keep in touch and keep following?
Well, Twitter would be the platform that we'll use to communicate and post up messages as we're entitled to post them up. We don't want, you see, we live in a kind of litigious age, and you have to be very careful what you say and do for fear that you might get a solicitor's letter. And we have to be conscious of that at all times. And this was a group that set out to do things right from the offset. The problem there is when you try to do things right, sometimes you can hit little buffers and you have to take a step back to go forward again. But I would put a pin in the calendar for 21 and look for Treaty United at, you know, 19s, 17s, 15s and 13s. And I'd be confident we'll be there.
John, thanks so much for taking the call.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And there's kind of a lot of grumbling about maybe we don't have enough Premier League players. But in terms of the Championship, as a...
But what's the point in grumbling about it?
But the step
I can't hold about it, can I? If they're not playing the play, what's the point of me grumbling?
But the step up to international football from the Championship, is it kind of is it easy to manage?
Well, I'll tell you about when we played in 2002. What's the point of grumbling? We had lads who were all at the bottom of the Premier League, real scrapping away, Kintz and Matty Holland and Gary Breen, who hadn't even got a club. What's the point of grumbling? So I don't subscribe to that, you know, you just... Whatever it is, whatever I've got, I'll get them together and make the best of them and try and make sure we qualify. Grumbling is not one of the things I do.
You can subscribe to each new episode of the ExtraTime.ie Sportscast on iTunes. Please give a rating or add a comment there to let us know your views.
Well, from one Munster club with a couple of problems to another, we're going to talk a little bit about Cork City here. Delighted to say we're joined by ExtraTime.ie's own Dylan O'Connell. Dylan, there's been trouble brewing there down in Cork for quite some time now at this stage. And I suppose we'll start off with looking at the takeover reports the last little while that Trevor Hamings, Preston's owner, is in talks to take over the club. What do we know on the latest on that?
So we know that there is an offer to buy the club from Trevor Hemmings and his parent company Grove More Limited. Well, his company Grove More Limited. Like, there was a lot of original confusion of people thought that Preston were actually buying Cork City, which isn't the case. Of like, I think about a month ago when it came out first that there was talks of Preston buying Cork City, that was a talk Preston are buying Cork City, but in reality it was Grove More Limited who owned Preston would own Cork City in a very like. You know, the owner of Olympiacos also owns Nottingham Forest. They would own the two clubs,
right? And in this scenario, would that include Turner's Cross?
That's a separate entity. The Munster FA own Turner's Cross to Cork City, right. But they have made an offer to buy Turner's Cross from the Munster FA. But the Munster FA are, the Echo reported that will be shut down any attempts to actually buy the ground. There was originally supposed to be, was it this week or next week, a meeting of the MFA with representative of all the associations, but I imagine that's been postponed over coronavirus fears and all that. So I imagine that's been kind of, the can has been kicked down the line there, but there is an offer to buy Turner's Cross from Grove More Limited.
Do we know how likely then this will be to go ahead, the current offer to buy Cork City from Trevor Hemmings?
You don't know, because a lot of people connected with Cork City have a strong, I suppose, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I apologise now if that causes people don't like me using that phrase, of what happened in 2009 with Tom Coughlin and 2007, 2008 when Arcaga came over, bought the club. So there is a kind of sense of hesitation of like, no, we don't want this towards the club. But then on the other hand, there is the kind of sense of desperation. Was it desperation? But there was a sense of, we have to challenge Dundalk. We have to challenge Shamrock Rovers among supporters of the fact that, like, without being, like, I'm from Cork, but the fact that we're the biggest county in Ireland, we should be competing at the highest level. So there is a kind of sense of frustration of people that we should. So again, like, I don't know myself. Like, Brian Lennox was giving an interview with Dennis Hurley from The Echo last week. Was it last week or the week before? And he was saying himself that Forass should consider selling to Grovemore Limited. So it's very up in the air. We don't know ourselves, because there's a lot of factors to play in this. Of people's own personal, I suppose, memories from 2009, 2010. We nearly lost the club. When the city was nearly lost to, I suppose, the day-to-day realities now, especially with the finances, which have been very in the national news over the last 18 months.
Yeah, and funny you mention that, because we talked about books on the show today, and one of the main ones was Neil Horgan's recent book. Name that slips my mind, I must enter it in there after. But so I'm sure from Neil's point of view, there might be a fourth book for him to come on Cork City and all the latest goings on, if he's still thereabouts with the club. But I want to ask you as well, I suppose, just because you mentioned Brian Lennox there, I saw an interesting quote. It might have been the same piece, actually, where he says, a club run by members is what you'd like to have, but unfortunately, when you don't have the backing of a large section of the business community in Cork, it's always going to be difficult. Why do you think that is? Because Cork fans, and I think a lot of League of Ireland fans, will be wondering why they're in this position. I mean, they take a lot of pride, as you said, in being fan-owned. The business model was sort of well-praised around the league. And why is it exactly that they feel that they don't really have the backing of the business section? Because, I mean, there is other clubs in the league who do that quite well.
Cork is a very strange city. And I mean that in the sense that Cork City are seen as still a new entity. And that's not me trying to kind of look at it as, oh, 2010, it was a new club. But like 1984 was 35 years ago. So a lot of businesses in Cork and a lot of big businesses, or the multinational corporations like Apple, let's say, who wouldn't have that much affinity towards, I suppose, local sporting enterprises, the same at Amazon. But then a lot of businesses in the city will be more linked towards the GA, and that's more tradition in the city. But there is business in the city involved in it. Like, you have Body Chef, you have, I suppose, the biggest one involved is probably UCC, who are the main sponsors of the club. And they also allow Cork City to use the Mardi Arena. But in terms of businesses in Cork, I think when the club were faced with a tax bill in last December, because we were faced with a tax bill last December of 150,000 from revenue, they did go to businesses around the city, and they were all refused. I don't know the names of the businesses that were refused, but you'd imagine, I suppose, trying to figure out the best way to say this, but there is a kind of scar people's memory as well of Cork City, because if you look at it, the club was founded in 1984. The club nearly went out of business in 1998. The club nearly went out of business in 2010. So, like, there was, but if you look at historically Cork football, you had Fords, you had Dunlops. There isn't a track record of success there long term. So I feel like that would give business a sense of hesitancy about getting involved.
No, like, that's fair enough. That's fair enough, and I suppose you'd have to think as well of the unease around the FAI at the moment, and also not only that, sure, Limerick have gone nearby, and revenue, I imagine, will be stinging slightly from that as well.
Like, if you look at business perspective, and like, I don't have a business brain myself at all, but like, the FAI has been a very tainted product, I'd say, for the last 12 months. It's been a year today since the FAI scandal. But if you look at, like, I'd say, if you look at the last 10 years since the economy started picking up, you've had Monaghan United go out of business, you had Cork City, you had what happened to us in 2010, you had what happened to Derry City, you had what happened, Dundalk nearly went out of business in 2012. So there's a very tainted, I suppose it's almost a lost leader of, like, if you're looking for the exposure as a from a business perspective to get involved, there isn't a lot there, because there isn't a TV deal, so you won't be exposed on television that wise. So, like, if you're a business trying to get involved, one, it is a tainted product. Two, there isn't a lot of exposure bar the two games a month that are on television, and which is a whole other topic of conversation. So there isn't that much incentive to get involved.
And what about
the... I don't know if I answered your question there.
Yeah, well, to an extent, yeah. And I suppose McDara can come in on this if he wants as well. What about this sort of 2 hours away from going bust thing that was sort of doing the rounds? Because that was a bit of a strange one. I think we've heard it reported that Alan Brown and Seanan Maguire, the clauses had to be to be sold on there. How has it got to a state where it's 2 hours away from going bust, and how have they managed to keep going since?
There's a very long answer I can give to this, where like there's been cash flow problems in the club going back the last year, and that can contributed to a number of factors. Like there was originally the budget was cut back by 300,000 in October 2018, which was kind of reflected the fact that they didn't get Champions League football for 2019. Dundalk won the league that year. So then last year they didn't get Europa League football last year. They overestimated, as far as I know, with the gate receipts. So if you look at 2018, City's average was 4,121. In 2019, the average was 2,505. So there is a drop there in income into the club straight away. And in 2019, they got knocked out of the Europa League by Progress Niederkorn 3-2 in aggregate. So that last year in total, they made 400,000 in, they had made a loss of 400,000. And that included, there was involved as well here, a VAT issue of 85,000, which was an error pertaining to 2016 and 2017. This is all online, and if anyone is interested, I can link the articles. And then at the start of the season, there was, towards the end of last year, start of this year, there was the 150,000 bill from revenue, which, from what I'm aware of, was in relation to Limerick FC, that when Limerick FC folded as an entity, revenue clamped down on League of Ireland clubs. So with the 150,000, City went for a bank loan to restructure their loans, as from what I understand, they were originally refused, which meant to get the money to cover this, they went to Preston North End, who gave them an offer originally of 199,000. They went to the FEI with the deadline 2 hours before the deadline with that, and that got refused, which got refused then. I apologize for a very long-winded explanation to all this.
That's fine. I mean, again, those of us who are able to keep up with the story constantly when everything else is going on, there's those of us who have just heard stuff like this bandied around and think they must be 2 hours away, and that was a week ago I heard that, so good to have that cleared up. McDarry, do you think, right, is there any positive spin we could put on this, in a sense that we're saying, look, an English Championship team who's recently recruited quite a few Cork players and got them across, would you say this would be in any way an appealing thing for players even? I'm trying to just look at this outside the box rather than talk about the depth and all the gloom that's around it. Would you say there's any appeal to players to go to Cork now with a move over to Preston as a possibility?
I think that might be a possibility for some of the players. That it might put them in the shop window, if you like, that someone involved in the club is also involved in the club in the UK. Might also help, I don't know, the change in rules for players to go across to the UK relating to Brexit. But of course, this all might be a moot point because of where football is, and dare I even say it, society is, in terms of the economy over the next few weeks. In relation to the investment, we have seen outside investment come into the league. Like, you've Gareth Keller has been, you know, pumping money into St. Pat's for quite some time. Like, I think it might be over a decade at this stage that he's been, you know, one of the main sources of, I think, income in terms of what their finances, as well as Gates. There's obviously been the US investment with Dundalk FC. And then, you know, maybe more pertinent and maybe relevant to what's happening at Cork is that Shamrock Rovers, you know, sold 25% of their club to Dermot Desmond for a couple of million last year. So there was a members club getting outside investment in. So just what intrigues me, and Dylan, you might be able to answer this, is the view that Forest would sell up lock, stock and barrel to the new investors, or would there be would they be able to retain some kind of ownership, or some, would there, is there any talk that there might be a fan membership on the board? I don't know if you know or what's been reported.
It's very up in the air at the moment, but like, the common consensus among fans with the club, and the common consensus among fans at the moment is, would there be a fan on the board of the club? or would there be in the clause of the contract that in the event they want to sell Cork City on, that the first option there is for us to take back control of the club. So there is the option of giving City some, of putting it back in the City's control, but it is very up in the air at the moment because it is very early days in negotiations. And a lot of it is a lot of conversations on match night. It's conversations before in the pub, because that, again, most people who are heavily involved with matches are all Forest members. So this is kind of the general conversation.
Right, well, I suppose in the meantime, is just keep a close eye on that story. Dylan, thanks very much for joining us to give us a bit of an update there. What we'll have to do in the meantime, I suppose, is promote the back catalogue of the Advent podcasts. We might release a few clips here or there and hopefully re-release a few episodes for you in the next couple of days, because those are sort of, I'm sort of reticent to say timeless classics, because they could be, they could eventually end up being dated. But Mokhtara, you joined me on quite a few. We really sort of hit everything from, well, the John the Baptist documentary to the best ever player debates. It was best ever player not to have left the league, which was quite a difficult one. We did a two-parter on Brian Kerr's Ireland, and we even did League of Ireland 11 facing Maradona's Argentina, which personally one of my favourites. And actually, Mokhtara, you did a piece on that you can find. Can't remember where. Pogba goal?
Pogba goal, but I think your favourite was definitely the one that we did on the Sky TV Dream Team series, no?
Yeah, it was up there, although I noticed some other organisation have started releasing Dream Team shows now, a little bit late. And also, well, Limerick Big Sam was also a personal favourite as well. For any Limerick fans who are listening in misery to some of the chat here today, you can go back and check that one out. Lads, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Dan.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to John Grant for joining us as well. Great to have him on. Do look out for more shows. We're going to try and get them to you weekly, if not a fair few extra podcasts here and there as well. So look out for those. And please look after yourselves. We'll speak to you soon.